Hooray, and thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be here in the Moral Sciences Club. And I'm just going to continue on the theme from last week. There's going to be talk about the self, and there's going to be talk about the phenomenal world. Okay. I'm going to talk not from a Kantian perspective, but more from a Buddhist perspective. This is the philosopher we will talk about today, Vasubandhu. He was a Buddhist philosopher in about the 4th, 5th century CE, belonging to the Abhidharma tradition. And he's the author of, the most important text in the Abhidharma tradition, which is the Abhidharma Kosh Bhashya, which is going to be the focus of today's talk. Let me tell you a little story about him just before we begin. So, like any good philosopher, he was in the Buddhist school in northern India, in Kashmir. In fact, Ray has lived in Kashmir. And so he went to the Buddhist school, and in the Buddhist school, this thing would often happen in the Buddhist monastery where they would do the teaching. The Hindus, there was a lot of debate between the Hindus and the Buddhists, and the Hindus would slip in just to find out or hear the arguments, while they were being discussed, the Buddhist arguments. And one Hindu philosopher from the Mimamsa tradition, Kumara, is known to have done that, Kumara in Kashmir all the time. So Vasubandhu was there learning, and he was always raising his hand in class. And he had questions all the time. The Buddhist teachers got a little bit suspicious. This guy's always got a question. About something, and he's raising objection. So he was thrown out of school. So he left Kashmir and went to central India. And there he wrote the Abhidharma Kosh Bhashya. Bhashya means commentary. Abhidharma Kosh is the Abhidharma doctrines, and then his own commentary, his objections, and how he sees these doctrines should be understood. That's the main text we're looking at. And the second one has got a little bit on action, karma siddhi prakaran, how the karmic process works. I'm going to say a little bit about that too. Okay, so here's the plan for the talk. I'm going to introduce a challenge. It's a challenge for the Buddhists as well as, I think, most contemporary philosophers. Then we'll look at Vasubandhu's response to the challenge. I'll say something about his account of agency and then say something about his account of responsibility, with the hope to for us to see how he might respond to the challenge. And I think his challenge invites us to rethink responsibility, rethink our responsibility practice. But before we go there, we've got to spend some time to see whether we can really make room for revisionism about our responsibility practices. Then I'll say a little bit about the revisionism right at the end. Okay, so here's the problem. For the Buddhists to begin with, the Buddhists believe in two doctrines, two important doctrines in the Buddhist literature. One, sorry, I've got a bit of a cold. Hopefully. One is the doctrine of karma. And the other is the doctrine of no self. Karma is best thought of as a hypothesis to justify belief in moral responsibility. You can think of it simply as, as you sow, so shall you reap. Good, bad actions result in pleasant or painful experiences for the agent as consequences in the non-immediate future. So they're not thinking about, what happens straight after the actions. They are consequences that the agent has to suffer or be rewarded at a later point in time. That's karma. And then Vasubandhu's no-self view in the Abhidharma Kosh Bhashya has these three features. He implies that there is no agent of action, there is no owner of experiences, And certainly there is no identity over time. If that's what the no-self view implies, it seems that it's going to be incompatible with the doctrine of karma. Karma requires identity over time. You know, X who did the action has to be the guilty party held responsible at a later time. But I think it's not just a problem for the Buddhists, it's a problem for most people who like a reduction of the kind of action in contemporary philosophy. And there's a lot of us who like that. So what is now called the standard theory of action also has the view is that there is no independent agency is to be explained in terms of causally efficacious mental states and events. They're also called event causal theories, following Davidson. The standard theory of action is meant to be an explanation of how a causal explanation of action. Michael Smith, another Monash connection, explains how the theory might be used not just for you know, a causal explanation, but also for a justification of action. So let me explain, Michael. So very simply, actions are bodily movements that are caused, rationalized, and we'll come to the rationalized a bit later, by an agent's desire for an end and a belief that moving the body in a certain way will, in the relevant way, will bring that end about. So the idea here to focus on is all that is required in the causation of action is mental, a belief and a desire. To get to justification, Michael, in the proper Australian way, says, let's just add common sense to this account. So the thought here is, you know, we think of, he draws a distinction between two kinds of reasons, motivated reasons and motivated. So here is Michael Buchanan. Suppose he's typing on his laptop. He thinks that typing on his laptop will produce paper whenever Michael types. Anyway, that's, you know, just the causal part of it. But the reason why he's doing it at a certain time is because he's made a commitment to deliver the paper that he's drawing. And so that's the normative reason. That's explaining, not just explaining, justifying why he's doing it. Standard theory is sensitive to available evidence about means to desired ends. So that's the means and belief. And common sense just adds another feature that desires are sensitive to judgments about what that is normative or, in some cases, moral reason to do. So Michael's account just says beliefs and desires are revisable in the light of evidence about means and evidence. So that's his explanation of responsible action. Responsible action simply piggybacks on responsible believing and desiring. David Wellman thinks that there is a problem for this account. And the problem for the standard theory is that it just leaves agents out of the picture. We have seen so far only mental states doing all the work of agency. Velleman tries to address this problem, but he certainly wants to work within the confines of the standard theory. So he doesn't want to add anything else to it. He suggests, you know, there is one candidate that can do the job of the agent. It's a second order desire. It's a desire to act in accordance with reason. Jennifer Hornsby is not happy with this kind of account. You know, she makes the point, which I think is similar to the complaint about incompatibility. She says no compounding of states and events in the naturalistic picture from which human beings are absent could constitute someone's doing something that she intentionally does. We need to have persons and agents. Just mental states will not do it. So her problem is that we cannot solve the no agent problem by adding more mental states. Event causal accounts of action are going to be incompatible with desert. Parfit also, in his later work, said something similar. If our acts were merely events in time, we could not deserve desert. Synchronic version of the problem. If there is no one who can be the agent, then there is no one who can be possibly responsible. But Parfit's reductionism about persons also gives you a dichronic version of the challenge. So remember, I'm not going to spend too much time on it because I think people will be familiar. Parfit's reductionism, one of the conclusions he draws is identity, numerical identity over time is not what matters. What matters is relational, psychological connectedness and continuity. And relational is not necessarily one-one. Cases of fission, cases of replication tell us it can be one-many. And so it shows that there is no numerically identical person in the future who can be held responsible for my present crimes. In his response to critics, this is in Ethics in 1986, Parfit accepts that if reductionism is true, then no one deserves to be punished for anything they do. So, you know, the challenge, the responsibility agency challenge is basically this. Our only conception of moral responsibility of desert presupposes numerically identical persons over time, but unfortunately, there is no such thing. So, what do we do? I want to say something now about Vasubandhu and his response to the challenge. But first, we'll also try and spell out his account of agency. This is in the chapter 9 of the Abhidharmakosha Bhashya. If any of you have looked at the Indian texts, you'll see that most of them will always have objections from the opponents. Considering the objections from the Nyaya-Visheshakas, who are Hindu philosophers, and they believe in something like the soul substance, Atman, as a substantial persisting agent. And, you know, it is the thing that carries the karmic residues. So it carries the karma with it. It is the bearer of responsibility. So they have a substantial agent, a persisting agent, and something that can, in the future, enjoy the rewards of good actions. And so here's the dialogue between Vasubandhu and a Nyaya philosopher, a hypothetical opponent. I've just put N and V to make it a little bit simpler. And this is not exactly a direct quote, just to make it a little bit simpler, but it's very close to what is in the text. So there being no self, here's the discussion. Who is the doer of these deeds and who is the enjoyer of the fruit? Vasubandhu says, what is the meaning of doer? The Nyaya answer, the doer is the one who does, the enjoyer is the one who enjoys. Not very helpful. Vasubandhu says, these are mere synonyms. They explain nothing about their meaning. But then the Nyaya come up with something more substantial. The doer is the one who's autonomous. For example, Devadatta, a common name, has the power in relation to bathing, eating, walking, and he's called the bather, eater, walker. That's the person who is autonomous and has the power in relation to actions to make the decision. And that's why we call him the eater, the walker, and so on. Vasubandhu says this definition is not acceptable. Why? Continues, what is meant by Devadatta? If a self is meant, then the example is worthless, since that's what is at issue. You know, we're trying to determine whether there is a self or not. It's not yet established, so that won't work. You can't say that the term Devadatta refers to a self. If it is the complex of the five psychophysical aggregates, so mental and physical states, then is meant, then Devadatta is indeed an agent. So yes, we can call the aggregates an agent, but he's not going to be autonomous. So there's two questions that Vasubandhu is raising and a claim that he makes that mental and physical states, or aggregates as they're called, skandhas in Sanskrit, are not autonomous. They depend on each other. A mental state, for example, if you have a desire to get a glass of water, you know, will make you make the body move in a certain way. With the belief there's water at the back, you will start moving in that direction. Mental and physical states cause each other. They're not autonomous. And in any case, we cannot say right now in the discussion that Devadatta could stand for something else other than, or could stand for the self, because we haven't established that. What Vasubandhu is using here is, I'll get to it in a minute. So Vasubandhu continues, therefore, no doer is characterized as autonomous, is apprehended. That which is the dominant cause of something is called its doer. But the self is not found to be a cause with respect to anything. Therefore, there cannot be a self. Forward from recollection, there is interest, from interest, from consideration, willful effort, from willful effort, vital energy, and from that action. So, what does the self do? So there are two things happening here. This is his reason for saying that the self does not exist, because the self is not doing anything in the explanation of action. You know, Vasubandhu in the Buddhist monk generally, you have this principle, if you like. I like to spell it out in the Quinean way of saying, you know, to be is to be causing the occupation. If you have to accept the existence of something, you have to be able to say what it does in an explanation. You have to specify its cause and effect. And the point, part of the point here, and I'll say more about that in a minute, part of the point, the first point, is the self is not found to be a cause with respect to anything, because we can give a complete explanation of action in terms of just mental states and bodily states. So what's the explanation of action? Let me explain that by an example first. So imagine yourself in the Indian mountains, the end of summer. You get the best mangoes I've met. Just as summer is going out, you get beautiful mangoes. You can almost smell the mango. It's hot. You know, you can smell the mango. From the smell, there arises a physical action. You know, you remember the last time you had that mango at the end of summer. You really want it. You know, from recollection, there is interest. There is interest in trying to procure the mango somehow. You want to find, you want to get a mango. From interest, there is consideration. You consider the environment. So you put your hand into your pocket and you try and get your wallet out, but you realize you've left your wallet in the hotel. So don't you? You're getting on a flight, going back to the UK that evening. This is your last chance to get the mango. What do you do? Well, you consider other options. One option is to steal the mantle and run for it. And you decide. You know, that consideration, there is willful effort. The willful effort is something like making the decision. That's what I'm going to do. You're a good runner. You can grab the mango and go. Nobody will be able to catch you. From that arises vital energy. Vasubandhu characterizes it in kind of a electrical impulse in the body from that effort, and from that you pick up the mango and you run. Recollection to bodily action, old mental states, nothing else was required. You've got a complete account of action. What is the autonomous self doing here? Nothing. So Vasubandhu thinks we can offer a simpler explanation of action in terms of causal relations between mental and physical factors, and we do not need autonomous agent. That's the Abhidharma principle I mentioned. Just an analogy to keep in mind. I think it's good to keep this analogy in mind when you're thinking about the self. As when you say, self is like a quack doctor chanting the mantras while the medicinal herbs do the work of healing. This often happens in India. He will come and give you, the doctor will come and give you the herbs, but also there's a lot of drama. So the drama is useless. Keep that in mind. Okay, so here's the explanation of action very quickly. I should move on. Recollection, interest, consideration, effort, energy. Vasubandhu regards consideration, effort, and energy as the mental part of action. So that's the mental component of action. And then there is bodily component. As we said in the quote, we have to reconceptualize the agent as the dominant cause of the action. What's the dominant cause? The notion of energy. Just that mental state. Think of it as desire or interest. So the question is desire suitable to play the role of the agent? Well, not if you want something that can be held responsible at a later time. So you won't have it. Let's see what he has to say about responsibility. So here's what he says. We do not say that the fruit arises from the exhausted deeds. Sorry, that's a typo. So he means the karmic fruit, the karmic result of the action at a later time does not arise from the exhausted deeds, deeds which are done in the past. From the distinctive feature of the transformation of that continuum, like seed and fruit. It does not arise from an exhausted seed. This time it's fine, but neither does it arise immediately. For if that seed did not proceed, there would not be the capacity to arise as a fruit of that sort. So, something to keep in mind, using the agricultural analogy here, and the seed metaphor is supposed to make that this point that, just from the seed, the fruit doesn't come straight away, but the kind of seed you have, good or bad, in terms of karmic action, or you can, the example that they use is from a grass seed, you won't get a wheat plant or a wheat as fruit. But if that seed did not proceed, then there would be capacity to arise as a fruit of that sort. Yeah, I'm going to say something, explain this in a little more detail. So, this is the reason why the Buddhists use the agricultural analogy. The idea is to show how we might think of responsibility in a selfless universe. So the quality of the seed matters, the kind of seed I said, good or bad. And the quality of seed here is likened to the intention, the willful effort and consideration, they're part of the intention. So the seed is likened to the deliberate intention, which determines the ethical quality of the action, and that sets off a process of definitive transformation. So you're on track to get a good result, bad result if you've stolen the mango. But it's not, the intention is not the only factor that determines the result. And that's why I like to use his example. This is Fassi Bandu's example of explaining this, giving a gift to a monk. So in the Buddhist monasteries, the monks were not allowed to have any money, and they always, as existed on charity, would go and beg for alms every morning. So gift giving is very important in that tradition. If you give a gift to the monk, the intention, he will get some good karmic residue. But that's not the only thing that happens. Vasubandhu says other external and internal factors also. In terms of external factors, he thinks about the recipient series. So what the quality of the monk, just like the seed alone is not going to give you the fruit because it has to be the right conditions to come to fruition. You need the soil, you need the right kind of weather, you need rainfall, and so on. Similarly, the seed, or in this case, the intention, the good intention you have in giving the gift, you want to do a generous, you do want to do a generous act. But the quality of the recipient also matters. In fact, they say that if a monk born on getting that gift, he had food from you, and the nutrition is so good that he's able to meditate for a long time, and he gets nirvana, he gets enlightened, and your karmic merit goes manifold. Nothing to do with you. It's how the external world cooperates as well. They even say, the material value of the gift also matters. And there are certain internal factors. So as the donor series sort of, if you like, progresses, what happens after the gift giving? If there is joy, you add the more positive karma. But if after giving the gift to the monk, you actually regret it, oh, I could have used that money to go out tonight, that's gonna count against the karma, the good karma you'll get. So it's a process that is set off by the action, but the internal and the external factors make a difference to how the series is transformed. Another quote from another Abhidharma text, but it's difficult to say who wrote it. It's from the Milindapanna, and it is a dialogue again with Nagasena, the Buddhist monk, and King Milinda. And King Milinda wants to ask, because the Buddha was talking about the no self view, he says, is it one person who commits a crime and another person whose hands and feet are cut off? That's pretty harsh punishment. But here's the response. It is as if new milk were to change in the process of time into sour cream, and from sour cream into fresh butter, and from fresh butter into clarified butter. And if we were to say that the sour cream, the fresh butter, clarified butter, each of them were the very milk itself, would we say, well, no, we wouldn't. So exactly the same way to the elements of being, so this is the skandhas again, the mental and the physical states, join one another in serial succession. One element perishes, another arrives and succeeding as each other, as it were, instantaneously. So neither as the same as the idea here is series is always changing. There is no numerical identity across time. And as we saw, Vasubandhu has explained, the series doesn't change because of just because of its own nature. but how it also interacts, closely interacts with other things around. So the phrase neither the same nor different is best understood as neither numerical identity nor numerical distinctness may be asserted. You know, when we are thinking about a series, we certainly can't talk about numerical identity. So the point is that if we talk at the level of aggregates, there is no room at all to talk about persons continuing over time in any sense of the term. And this impersonalist picture, I think, shows that our ordinary responsibility practices, holding up one person responsible, are going to be completely ungrounded, something analogous to Parfit's extreme claim. That's the kind of thing I think we are getting at in getting from Vasubandhu, that no ground for our responsibility practices, and we need to rethink them. I'm going to miss this slide just because of time. So here's the upshot. Agents and bearers of responsibility are different things. He told you what the agent is. It's the interest, but it is not numerically identical with bearers of responsibility. Since the search for a guilty individual is futile, no one ever deserves to be punished for anything they did. What Vasubandhu's view is showing us, I think, is that no self is incompatible with the way we ordinarily think about moral responsibility or karmic responsibility. And so, you know, calls for some kind of revision. Question is, what kind of revision? Well, some people say no revision is required. They will be reading Strawson on freedom and resentment. Just take the normative turn. In fact, you know, this was, I was in Cornell last year and David Shoemaker said, what needs to be done about this? Just go and read freedom and resentment. Because the claim people think that Strawson makes is that our interpersonal responsibility practices are just impervious to metaphysical doctrines. So here is what Strawson says in response to the question about the rational justification of our ordinary interpersonal attitudes. First, that such a question could only seem real to someone who had utterly failed to grasp the purport of the fact of our natural human commitment to ordinary interpersonal attitudes. The commitment is part of the general framework of human life, not something that come up for review. So those of you who've read Strawson, he's talking about determinism. What if determinism is true? What should we do to our responsibility and practices? Blaming, resentment, gratitude, so on and so forth. What? And his answer is, no justification is required for our practices because this commitment is part of the general framework of human life, not something that can come constitutive of humanity. You know, they make us what we are. We don't need any metaphysical justification for these practices. And second, even if we could imagine what we cannot have, if we, you know, could change our practices, what we cannot have, I think, is because he thinks we have no choice in this matter. Even if we could imagine what we cannot have with respect to those practices, then we could choose rationally only in the light of assessment of the gains and losses to human life. So Strawson thinks it's psychologically impossible for us to give up treating, you know, each other as he calls it, the participants in an interpersonal relation. We are by nature social beings, and we need to treat each other as participants in a social practice. And, you know, in some cases we take the objective attitude, but that's, you know, we do only in extreme cases. So we don't have a choice in this matter. It's psychologically impossible for us if we continue to have interpersonal lives, then we need to have these reactive attitudes, as he called them, practices of blame, responsibility, and so on and so forth. But you know, if there was a choice in this matter, which we cannot have, he's not willing to really discuss it. You know, it could be done only if we look at the gains and losses to human life. Strauss, of course, thinks there'd be too much of a loss, and so we shouldn't go that way. But that's the line I want to take. First, you know, I want to question his claim that it is psychologically impossible for us to give up our responsibility practices. And that there would be a lot of work on cultural heterogeneity in emotion studies. Not all cultures have the same emotion. I can give you lots of examples, but right now I'm going to only stick to one. So this is the Utku, small group of First Nations people in Canada. And she agrees, has been following them since the 70s. And they go, right, you might say it's about Tibet, and they, her first claim, early claim was, you know, they don't have, they're not taught, you know, what to express their resentment. They're not taught in a way to even think about, you know, what we might call anger. The society is so interdependent, the conditions are so harsh, you're so interdependent on each other, that if you were to express your anger, it would harm cohesion. And the Utku now, so in a 2000 paper, she discusses, they live in, you know, in big settlements and modern housing and modern conditions. They have electricity and all of that. But even in spite of all those differences, they still do not express anger in the way me and you would. They just, you know, haven't learned that emotion. The kids haven't been taught it. It's the way they're socialized. So sometimes now you will see that they have a community radio channel in which they send messages to each other. So no one is going to, you know, if you look up to them, no one is going to get angry or at those facials. But sometimes in the community radio channel, they will send you personal invitations for dinner, they will make good comments, but they will also slip in something like, you know, this is not very nice. That's as much in terms of resentment they would expect. Do they have been washing them? So, but, you know, this is something we can talk about. So there are, and both Buddhists say anger is something we need to get rid of, but there, I think there is enough reason to think that there is cultural variation. Emotion is widespread, and it makes difference not just to the expression, not just to how you express those responses, but also to the occurrence of those reactions. Dutch anthropologist has done a lot of work in this area, Leah Snyder. Worth looking at some first studies. We can talk more about that. So Strawson just takes it for granted that our lives will be greatly diminished if we give up these interpersonal responsibility practices, but I don't think it is that obvious. Boom, the Kerr Boom has this discussion. You know, he's a hardened compatibilist, and he thinks there is a possibility of replacing reactive attitudes with what he calls non-basic deserty ceremonies. And can be replaced with moral protest and sadness. And you get, you know, it is possible our lives will in fact, or better, not be diminished. Now, these non-basic deserty surrogates is not the way I want to go. Nor do I think moral protest and sadness can really do the work of anger. But the point here is that it's a strategy for seeing that whether we can, we can evaluate the gains and losses of the proposed impersonal morality. It sounds very odd to the ear to even think about it. There are no selves, there are no persons. Is there a morality? What are we going to do? So, just in terms of time, I'm going to go through this quickly and just make this claim that Parfit also thought of making some revision. He was not happy with the way Strawson, thinking in the prescriptivist way. But Parfit, as some of you might know, he went from the moderate claim, extreme claim. He was never, at least in Reasons and Persons, he does not take a position on one or the other. He hesitates. And he settles, I think, sometimes, or at least responsibility theorists, contemporary people working on responsibility, thinks we can run with the moderate claim. Right? So the moderate claim just says the amount of our practical concerns are grounded by relation R. So it the relation R is the degree of psychological connectedness and continuity. Proportional to that degree, you can have a degree of desert. So don't need to change anything. It's not that, there is one person who's wholly responsible, but there is a degree of responsibility depending on how much continuity there is with the previous self. That's the moderate claim. I don't want to go that way because I think, that's not the way that the Buddhists are suggesting. As I said, their impersonalist claim pushes us towards the extreme claim. And the worry, I'm just going to not go through these examples because of time. The resistance, I think, from the no-self metaphysics comes from the fact that it requires us to abandon or significantly change our most cherished moral practices. And the worry is, are we giving up on morality? I don't think so, because Buddhist philosophy is explicitly motivated by the explicit by the goal of eliminating or at least reducing. I mean, now that's got to be something worth doing, and the goal I think is worth pursuing. And the metaphysics drives a novel and an interesting moral framework. I'm not going to say too much about the moral framework. Just quickly give you a sense, this is the last section, and trust me, it's not very long. Quickly give you a sense of what kind of revisionism we might think of. Following the Buddhists. What they want is, we need a way of undercutting the reactive attitudes. By that, I mean the person-directed attitudes. We need to, the Buddhists are well known, you don't want blame, you don't want anger, you don't want jealousy. Part of the Buddhist practice is to get rid of all those things. But there's also the worry about the positive reactive attitudes, right? Love, compassion, gratitude, for example. It's a relation between a benefactor and a beneficiary. Seems to be person-directed. The Buddhists want to keep gratitude. It's a very important practice, even advanced Buddhist practitioners. Have to do what they call gratitude practices every day. Thank the world for the sun and the rain and the water. So what the idea here is that, what we want to do is to preserve what is important about the roles of the reactive attitudes while bringing on an overall improvement. And let me explain this by anger. So the idea is not, the Buddhists say you need to get rid of anger because it is rooted in something negative, which is hatred. But what replaces anger is a whole lot of things which will recover some of the positive benefits of anger. So things like you need patience and forbearance. That those things fear of wrongdoing and anticipatory guilt, those things will, at least reduce bad actions and things, occasions for getting angry. A suit of those emotions. Plus, it's only, in the monastery that people are supposed to totally get off anger. And there's a whole set of vows that the Buddhists take, which make sure that, there is no occasion for if some anything like anger to arise. Because there won't be, the kinds of things that will cause anger to arise. So one of the things that causes anger to arise is, if you're insulted or mistreated. Those are the things. They have specific vows against not insulting another monk. They have vows about not even talking about another monk behind their back. All of those things, which are likely to cause anger to arise, is ruled out by the vows. And so what we have is something like, a combination of emotions, sentiments, and vows that together play the anger role. They at least recover some of the positive functions of anger. So one of the positive functions of anger is not to be mistreated. If you're someone who's likely to get angry, you won't be insulted, you won't be mistreated. And that's kind of taken care in this in the Buddhist setup. Just very quickly about what about gratitude? So as I said, they do gratitude practices every day. But what happens? The term for gratitude that we translate gratitude in the Buddhist, in the Pali, is called katanu, which just means literally acknowledging what has been done. So when the advanced practitioners are doing gratitude practices, they're not saying thank you. What they're saying is the attitude that is they're expressing is called anumodana, which is expressing joy that a good deed has been done. And everyone expresses joy on the occasion, irrespective of who the donor is and who the beneficiary is. These are, I mean, at least in the monasteries, these are ceremonies done so that the whole community gets involved. It's not about one person giving a gift to another. It is a community event. And the expression of gratitude is celebrating the good actions that are done. These are not person directed, they are directed towards action. So that's the idea. We can think of recovering what was good about the reactive attitude without, without having a person directed away, without having them directed at persons, and persons having hope. The hope is that we get a better ethical perspective. No self, no self-interest. I'll stop here. There's more work to be done here. This is very much work in progress. I've done some work on anger and on gratitude, but there is other reactive attitudes. But I think, we can think of a selfless moral framework that can do the work of morality and perhaps do better than our ordinary framework.